This is Politico Energy. Stay tuned after the show for a message from Chevron.
Dan Juergens, he is a longtime energy kind of advisor, researcher, consultant kind of guy. When I think an energy CEO needs a shoulder to cry on, he calls Dan Juergens and they talk over double scotches or something. His other claim to fame is he's written like 3 books on the energy industry, one of which won a Pulitzer Prize. In this latest one that he wrote, you know, I just finished reading, it just came out, was basically how the U.S. oil and gas boom has rearranged the geopolitical map.
And why did you want to talk to him now, particularly at this moment?
Because it really struck me that this guy has been around for so long that, you know, as we've seen this kind of like, you know, double or triple threat hitting the industry right now, he would probably be the best one to be able to gauge of, you know, whether, quote unquote, this time it's different.
Today, my colleague Ben LaFave's one-on-one conversation with Pulitzer Prize winner and energy guru Dan Juergens about the future of fossil fuels after the pandemic. It's Friday, September 18th, and I'm Kelsey Tamburino.
Obviously, the coronavirus outbreak, you know, was a huge slam on demand, but that's, I mean, it's certainly bad, but it almost seems like it's, you know, at some point, hopefully, you know, coronavirus will be under control. I mean, but do you think even kind of X pandemic, that this downturn is, you know, different?
This is one time when this time is different. To begin with, it was a demand shock of a kind that's never happened before, where basically governments shut down their economies in what I call an economic dark age, which we're still, you know, really struggling to get out of. But then there are these larger secular forces out there too, which is the shifts in investor sentiment, compounded by low returns for investors. And so I think that the shale industry and the industry in general have two different sets of issues with investors. One is returns, and the other is the ESG agenda.
What are your thoughts on whether we've reached peak demand now? What do you think is going on?
I think that we still have about another 10 to 12 years of demand rising before we hit the peak. And then when we hit the peak, it isn't that it plummets and collapses, it just starts to decline. I mean, you know, just one number to keep in mind, the average car in the United States now stays on the road for 12 years. So those cars aren't going away. But it is a time of uncertainty, and, you know, and the big uncertainty is how is the world going to be changed when COVID is behind us?
It's interesting to me, and I don't know what you think of, it almost seems like there's a split in the evolutionary line now. You know, you had the original kind of 7 sisters, but do you remember a time when they were almost like, or when they were so divergent on a policy or a market force?
I think there's really never been a time in recent times when you see such a wide variety of strategies among the major international companies. And you have the large European companies saying, we really want to turn ourselves into energy companies, not just oil and gas companies, and particularly looking at electric power as businesses they want to move into, and looking at, you know, at technology and batteries and so forth. I think the U.S. companies are saying, well, we should really focus on being really efficient oil and gas companies. But I think U.S. companies are not going in a big way into renewables. And so it is striking when you see the difference. There is an Atlantic Gulf that separates the global industry now.
One of the things he said was that there's now like basically 2 eras. There's the pre-Paris era, you know, before the Paris Climate Accord, and then there's the post-Paris era. And while the European industry and market has kind of gone along with the Paris Accord regulations, the U.S. hasn't done that under President Trump. But regardless of that, Juergens said, the investor sentiment has gone along with the Paris kind of road, I guess.
So this change in sentiment is reflected in how much environmental, social, and governance factors, or ESGs, are becoming increasingly important in investments, which could eventually also reshape federal regulators.
Do you see if we have a change in administrations at some point and ESG issues kind of become de rigueur for the SEC, for the Securities Exchange Commission?
Yeah, I think, you know, under a Democratic administration, it's likely that financial regulators will put more emphasis on ESG. One of the things that, you know, kind of really struck me when I sat back, you know, you write a book and you look at the whole picture, is how the world divided from December 2015. There's one era called before Paris and another era called after Paris, and the degree to which Paris has become the benchmark by which people do ESG ratings, that governments operate, and asking companies, how does your strategy comport with the objectives of the Paris Agreement? And that has become something that is certainly spread in the financial community, and the financial community itself is, you know, feeling pressure from activists and others. And so, you know, I think that ESG is just going to continue to grow, and managements are going to wrestle with it.
So his point was that the market almost seems to be kind of going towards enforcing Paris style targets without the government getting involved as of yet.
Okay, so there was a lot there, but did he talk about the role of fossil fuels on the world stage and some of the geopolitics?
You know, BP came out with its energy analysis saying that oil demand globally has pretty much plateaued. Juergen's point was that doesn't mean it's going to crash. But what's going to happen is, you know, coal is going to continue to be squeezed out, and natural gas will kind of increase in importance to kind of cut down emissions. But with the U.S. being able to basically, you know, produce as much oil and gas as it wants to a certain extent, that gives us a lot of leverage in geopolitics where we didn't have before. One of the things you have in your book is, you know, Russia and Gazprom maybe being a little bit heavy-handed and, you know, using gas as a political tool. You know, you quoted this energy minister saying U.S. LNG exports to Europe would help, you know, quote-unquote, depoliticize European gas supply. Now, I was wondering, you know, seeing what we have with Nord Stream, I mean, do you think that's holding up to be true? Or, you know, if you're going to use energy as a diplomacy, you know, tool, does that kind of cut both ways where some of these countries are going to feel things a little heavy handed?
I think it was getting depoliticized. You know, Europe gets substantial amount of its natural gas from Russia, but Europe now has choices for two reasons. One, in light of what happened with Russian gas in Ukraine more than a decade ago, the system is much more flexible, so you can move gas around very easily. Secondly, LNG, including U.S. LNG, really changes the picture. But then you get to Nord Stream 2, that was just weeks away from being finished when the U.S. put sanctions on it to stop it, saying it was a threat to U.S. national security. This has put the politics back into European natural gas, and it's also created a lot of complications in U.S. relations with Germany, with threats to actually put sanctions on a German port. On the other hand, Russia and China, for many reasons, coming closer together, including because of energy, and also, of course, because of their common opposition to the United States right now.
And, you know, Joe Public maybe doesn't realize that, but he did point to one person who actually realized this quite acutely, and that was Russian President Vladimir Putin.
In the book, I don't use the first person, but I was at an event in St. Petersburg where I asked Putin, I had the first question. I said, well, what are you going to do about diversifying your economy, being less dependent on oil prices? But I mentioned the word shale, and he started shouting at me in front of like 3,000 people, an uncomfortable experience. But I realized why is because he saw U.S. oil and gas, the shale development, as giving the U.S. a flexibility that it didn't have before, and in that sense, diminishing Russian influence in the world. And that, I mean, to me, that's another, a very personal, vivid example of the change.
Subscribe to Politico Energy wherever you listen and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want more energy news in your inbox, subscribe to our newsletter at politico.com/morningenergy. Carlos Prieto is our producer. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. And our executive producer is Irene Noguchi. Our editor is Matt Daly. And on the show this week,
Alex Guillen,
Zach Coleman,
Ben LaFave,
Eric Wolf.
Thank you, and we'll be back again Monday.
Chevron has spent over $1 billion building one of the largest integrated carbon capture and storage facilities, capable of capturing up to 4 million tons a year. Learn more at chevron.com/possibilities.